Noon, southwest wind gusting up to 15 miles per hour. Chance of snow before midnight with overnight lows in the single digits.
We believe he was radicalized since he's been here in this country. We do believe it was through connections in his home community and state.
The FBI continues to investigate the shooting of National Guard members in Washington, D.C. What do we know about the alleged gunmen?
For Monday, December 1st, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour to Nevada, where a massive data center campus is going up outside Reno.
The center is in the nation's driest state and will need billions of gallons of water to operate.
Data centers generate a lot of heat, and the easiest, most efficient way of cooling them down is water.
And in Miami, a new museum that bills itself as the first dedicated to graffiti and street art.
Trains for me was like an open gallery. All types of people can see it, tourists, people going to work, poor people. It became a moving canvas.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The White House is acknowledging that a second strike on an alleged Venezuelan drug boat in the Caribbean happened on September 2nd and specified that Navy Admiral Frank Bradley carried out the order. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth ordered the first strike on the boat and a subsequent strike that killed all survivors on board, as NPR has previously reported. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt defended that second strike at her latest briefing.
With respect to the strikes in question on September 2nd, Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated.
Lawmakers from both sides of the aisle have said that the second strike may have constituted a war crime. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
The White House says President Trump's most recent medical examination confirmed that the president remains in excellent health. NPR's Rob Stein has more on new information about the president's scan.
The White House released a statement from the president's physician stating that Trump remains, quote, in excellent overall health. Questions about the president's health have been swirling since he underwent another exam in October that included a test known as an MRI. MRIs are sometimes used to assess the health of vital organs. The White House physician's statement says the president's imaging showed his heart, arteries, blood vessels, and other major organs all appear normal. Trump is 79, making him the oldest person ever elected as president. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Gasoline prices have dipped to their lowest level in 4 years, but as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, the discounts don't extend to the diesel pumps.
AAA says the average price of regular gas nationwide has dropped to $3 a gallon, even as tens of millions of people hit the road over the holiday weekend. Truck drivers, however, are not enjoying lower prices. The average cost of diesel fuel is close to $3.74 a gallon, 20 cents more than this time last year. Airbus says most of its A320 passenger jets have now completed a software fix that was ordered on Friday. U.S. Airlines scrambled to make the update during the busy travel weekend. It was also a busy shopping weekend, both in stores and online. Despite shaky consumer confidence, shoppers are hoping to take advantage of holiday bargains. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
West Virginia's governor says a National Guard member who was shot last week in Washington, D.C. is still in serious condition, but has shown some positive signs. Governor Patrick Morrisey says 24-year-old Air Force Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf gave a thumbs up that he could hear a nurse's question and wiggled his toes. Another National Guard member, 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom, died after the shooting. U.S. stocks dropped today after last week's rally. This is NPR News. More than 800 people are still missing after devastating floods killed over 1,000 people last week in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand. Indonesia's president says more action needs to be taken to confront climate change. Flooding and landslides killed more than 600 in Indonesia alone. As delegations from the U.S. and Russia prepare to meet in Moscow to discuss the latest proposal to end Russia's war in Ukraine, NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was buttressed by allies in Paris.
Zelensky was welcomed by an honor guard at the Élysée Presidential Palace.
Les États-Unis d'Amérique.
President Emmanuel Macron said the U.S., Ukraine, and Europe want peace, but there are doubts Russia is serious. He said the Kremlin had turned down four proposals and continues to bomb Ukraine nightly. The two leaders spoke by video to dozens of European leaders and allies in the Coalition of the Willing, the force committed to guaranteeing peace in Ukraine once the fighting stops. Macron and Zelensky also spoke to U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and President Trump. Their message, Ukraine and Europe must be at the negotiating table for a robust and lasting peace. It's their territory and security at stake. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
A federal antitrust trial against NASCAR has opened with Michael Jordan in attendance. The retired NBA star co-owns a team that's suing the racing organization. They allege NASCAR is monopolistic and forces teams to comply with rules and financing they oppose. Several potential jurors were dismissed due to their admiration of Jordan. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour on this Monday afternoon, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering opportunities in the tap room all season long for holiday shopping and gathering. More about events, pop-up shops, beer releases, and more on Facebook. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
Is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The FBI continues to investigate last week's shooting in downtown Washington, D.C. that left one guardsman dead and critically wounded another. The alleged gunman, 29-year-old Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, who worked with the U.S. military in Afghanistan, was wounded in the exchange of gunfire and is still hospitalized. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman has been covering this, and he joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Tom, I understand the FBI is talking with family and friends of the alleged shooter. Any sense at this point of a motive?
You know, we don't have a sense of a motive now, and all we have so far is an interview with Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, who was on NBC's Meet the Press, and she was convinced of a motive. Let's listen.
But I will say, we believe he was radicalized since he's been here in this country. We do believe it was through connections in his home community and state, and we're going to continue to talk to those who interacted with him, who were his family members, talk to them. So far, we've had some participation, but anyone who has information on this needs to know that we will be coming after you and we will bring you to justice.
But Secretary Noem provided no evidence as far as radicalization. And again, she said they're still talking to family members, others in the community. We know the FBI said it seized laptops and phones from his home. He lived with his wife and five children in Bellingham, Washington, north of Seattle. The U.S. Attorney's Office said as soon as he's medically able, he'll appear in federal court.
You noted that he worked with the U.S. military in Afghanistan. What did he do?
Well, he was a member of a paramilitary group called Zero Unit that operated out of the southern city of Kandahar, working with U.S. forces as well as the CIA. They were headquartered in a compound once owned by the Taliban's leader, Mullah Omar. Now, this Zero Unit was a highly select group that would mount night raids, go after Taliban fighters. They were pretty brutal, and there were reports from Human Rights Watch that they engaged in torture and also illegal killings.
I know that you spent a lot of time in Kandahar, Tom. What kind of reputation did these units have?
Well, again, some of the U.S. military I spoke with back around that time, let's say 2011 through 2015, they would say, hey, the units are tough, but their work helps protect American troops. I remember talking with one paramilitary leader around this time in Kandahar, General Abdul Razik. He was particularly brutal, according to reports by the UN and Human Rights Watch. And some of these analysts and American lawmakers, also, you know, some military officers I spoke with, they sharply criticized him, suggested that U.S. break ties with him, not supply him with any weapons. And he said, that'll never happen.
Tom, there has been some reporting to suggest that his work with a paramilitary unit took a toll on him, and it may have been a contributing factor in the shootings. How so?
Right. Our colleague Brian Mann spoke with a refugee resettlement volunteer who worked with Lochinwall and the family and spoke anonymously because of the sensitivity of the story. This volunteer worked with him over the past several years and noticed a deterioration in his mental state. He would sit in his room in the dark. He stopped working. He worked for a time in the food processing industry, also a laundry. He would take long drives as far away as Illinois and Arizona. The concern was more about possible PTSD because of his military work and more worry about self-harm than harming others.
Last thing, Tom, he was vetted, right? Because there was a suggestion by Trump administration officials that he was not vetted before entering this country.
No, that does not appear to be the case. He would have been carefully vetted to work with the CIA. And when he came to the U.S. after the fall of Kabul in the summer of 21, he would have been vetted again in way stations like Germany or Italy before arriving in Washington Dulles Airport. I was at some of these locations and saw the vetting process myself. And of course, Juana, he was granted asylum just this past April.
NPR's Tom Bowman, thank you.
You're welcome.
Pope Leo XIV is in Lebanon, holding prayers, holding meetings with Christian and Muslim religious leaders. His focus is encouraging peace and tolerance in a region scarred by conflict. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports as she travels with the first American pope.
In a tented hall in Beirut's Martyrs Square, with helicopters flying above and Lebanon's iconic Mohammed Al-Amin Mosque visible to one side, leaders from Lebanon's many religions, Christian, Muslim, Druze and others, sit together with Pope Leo and take turns to speak. Aram I, head of the Armenian Apostolic Church.
Your Holiness, you are visiting a country where unity in diversity and diversity in unity is an existential reality.
With its history of sectarian civil war and a political system based on the distribution of political power between religious faiths, Lebanese have long been part of a complex society that includes 18 different recognized religions. 12 of those are Christian denominations, and Lebanon has the largest proportion of Christians in the Middle East. Religious figures spoke about this and about Israel's recent war with the Lebanese militia Hezbollah that further damaged an already weakened state. We have been compelled to defend ourselves by resisting the occupier who has invaded our land, said Sheikh Ali Al-Khatib, the vice president of the Higher Shia Islamic Council. We are certainly not lovers of weapons, nor of the sacrifice of our sons. Shia leader Khatib appealed to Pope Leo to free Lebanon from Israeli airstrikes that continue despite a ceasefire. Between speeches, this school choir sang for Pope Leo, children from Lebanon's mostly Shia town of Sur in the south of the country, close to the border with Israel, that has been hard hit by airstrikes. In the audience, there's hope that just maybe Pope Leo can do something to bring real peace to Lebanon, says Lebanese journalist Zizi Estefan.
He's a pope, after all. He should have a role to play, especially for peace, for pushing things on and working for peace.
Pope Leo did not address the conflict directly, instead reflecting on Lebanon as biblical land.
A land exalted by the prophets of the Old Testament, who beheld in its towering cedars emblems of the righteous soul that flourishes beneath heaven's vigilant gaze.
The Pope has received the warmest reception in Lebanon. He was welcomed with traditional Debke folk dancers around his Popemobile and crowds cheering through the rain, celebrating this moment of peace after so much recent suffering. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Beirut.
Art takes over Miami this week with the arrival of the annual Art Basel Fair and a host of satellite shows. One of the new exhibitions chronicles an art form the city has become known for, one developed by teenagers in New York City in the 1970s before spreading around the world. NPR's Greg Allen reports on the Museum of Graffiti.
In Miami's Wynwood neighborhood, large colorful murals cover the exteriors of almost every building. It makes sense that this neighborhood is home to a place that bills itself as the first museum dedicated to graffiti and street art. Inside the Museum of Graffiti, one of the first exhibits isn't of art, but of an artist's medium. In this case, cans of Rust-Oleum spray paint. Museum founder and curator Alan Kett picks up what he says is a special can.
This is a Cascade Green Rust-Oleum paint. This one is from 1973.
Today, Kett says collectors will pay $1,000 for a vintage can. It's a color, he says, that was prized by graffiti artists.
This green was only made by Rust-Oleum. No other brand made something so nice. And so when you paint a rusty train with this mint green, the effect is quite extraordinary.
Kett co-founded the Museum of Graffiti 6 years ago to tell the history of an art movement that began in the 1960s and 70s with teenagers putting their names and their paint on surfaces throughout New York City. One of those teenagers, now 61 years old, is John Perello. He goes by the name John One. His painting has covered an Air France jet and been featured on a Hennessy cognac label. He lives in France now, but began nearly 50 years ago as a teenager tagging buildings and subways in New York City.
I didn't have no money, so I was stealing. I was stealing all my spray paint, and that was my first grant, I would say.
John One says he started out tagging, putting his name on buildings in his Washington Heights neighborhood. His work became more elaborate over time, and like many of his friends, he began painting on New York subway cars.
Trains for me was like an open gallery. All types of people can see it, tourists, business people, people going to work, poor people. It became sort of like a moving canvas, a moving museum that would come to you.
Then, as now, that type of guerrilla art was not popular with authority figures and others who consider it vandalism. But early on, some artists began moving from the subways into the studio. The Museum of Graffiti's exhibition features paintings from a key moment in the development of graffiti art. It was the first time, Alan Kett says, that work by young street artists was featured in a New York gallery.
The Razor Gallery show in 1973 was that big boom that showed these young artists that they had a lane, that they had an opportunity that they could pursue.
In the decades since that show, Kett says, graffiti has spread around the world and won acceptance by the art world, luxury brands, and even governments. Work by some artists, including Jean-Michel Basquiat and Banksy, have sold for millions.
So now graffiti artists are called street artists. And they are commissioned by cities around the world to create monumental public art projects.
Kett has consulted with museums on exhibitions of graffiti and street art, but says despite its broad popular appeal, it hasn't yet gotten the recognition it deserves from the art establishment. That's what led him to open the Museum of Graffiti. Blue chip institutions will hold temporary exhibitions, he says, but have been slow to add street art to their permanent collections. John One says even as a teenager, he knew it was just a matter of time before the art he and others were doing on subway cars gained recognition. But street art, he says, still has a certain stigma.
It's like having that girlfriend that you don't want to show your moms, you know? You know, you love her and everything, but you don't want to bring her home, you know? So it's a little bit like that. Sometimes I feel like that.
John One's solo show and other exhibitions will be at Miami's Museum of Graffiti through June. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Area book lovers are invited to a book swap at the KBXE studio in Bemidji. Bring a book, take a book on Wednesday, December 10th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Also talk about your favorite books with fellow KAXE, KBXE readers and staff and What We're Reading host Tammy Bobrowski. There will also be used books from the Red Door Bookstore available for purchase. We receive support from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair, as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive, now through December 12th. There are several drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. We receive support from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. My Neighbor to Love Coalition in Brainerd is working to end homelessness for 30 neighbors this December. Construction is nearly complete on 19 units at Creekside Community, but funds are needed to purchase basic household furnishings. Learn more at mntlc.org/donate. You can cut down your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forests. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. There's a sensory-friendly Santa event December 4th through the 6th at Northland Arboretum in Baxter. Register for a 15-minute time slot and learn more at northlandarb.org. Click on events.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them. Offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And from Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A massive data center campus is going up outside Reno, Nevada. And when I say massive, when it's finished, its footprint will be larger than the city next door. All that computer hardware is expected to consume a lot of water. And Nevada is the nation's driest state. Caleb Radel with the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
Brian Armin, a commercial real estate broker, drives to the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center.
Directions to 2555 USA Parkway.
Keenan Eagle Inc.
The center rises from the sagebrush like a pop-up book.
The building that you see up on the hill there, that's Vantage Data Center's Edge Core. That's a data center that's under construction.
Here, outside of Reno, Armin says tech giants are racing to turn desert land into the backbone of the internet and AI. It checks all the boxes for data centers. Plenty of land, few climate-related disasters like hurricanes and flash floods, and big tax breaks.
We've had a massive amount of data centers that have shown up and more that are looking.
By 2027, AI is expected to account for 28% of the global data center market, according to Goldman Sachs. That's more than double its current share. This data center boom is not just happening in northern Nevada. Across the West, including Colorado, Wyoming, and Arizona, states have rolled out major tax incentives to attract data centers. But rising concern over their water use is fueling public pushback. In Tucson, Arizona, for example, outcry over a data center project led officials to pull support.
Data centers generate a lot of heat, and the easiest, most efficient way of cooling them down is water.
That's Stanford hydrologist Nusha Ajami, who says these centers are like thirsty crops. But permanent.
You have to continuously water them, right? So it doesn't provide that flexibility that's needed, especially during dry or drought periods.
A 2024 federal report found that U.S. data centers consume 17 billion gallons of water a year. But that's a drop in the bucket compared to industries like mining or farming, which use billions of gallons every day. But demand from data centers is expected to double or even quadruple soon, according to that report. And Ajami says in the arid West, where water is finite,
people are concerned about their water and who's using it and how.
This comes as climate change is shrinking Western snowpacks, says Sean McKenna. He leads hydrologic sciences at the nonprofit Desert Research Institute.
And that's not good because snow is like our water tower, right? That's how we store that moisture for later in the year.
Today, about 75% of the West is in drought. In Nevada, more than half its groundwater basins are overallocated. More water exists on paper than underground. Still, the water district for the data center hub outside of Reno isn't alarmed yet. It holds rights to more than 4 billion gallons a year. Sherry Whalen, the district's general manager, says it has the water to handle the center's growth.
Our plan is not to bring water in from anywhere else. Our plan is to fully and responsibly utilize the resources we have.
Put another way, she says,
what we're trying to do is make sure that nothing basically goes vertical without a water resource tied to it.
Several data center developers outside of Reno say they plan to use more efficient cooling systems to reduce water use. That mirrors a broader shift happening nationwide. Dean Ball, an AI policy expert, says data centers are trying to shrink their water footprint.
These days, the trend in AI data center design is really to go to closed loop water systems.
That means the water is reused over and over. Still, in the driest parts of the country, available water remains a concern and is tightly controlled by regulators. Right now, Nevada has about 60 data centers, with at least a dozen more planned in the coming years. For NPR News, I'm Caleb Bradle in Reno.
In the season of food, family, and traditions, let's hear about fry bread. Flour, salt, baking powder, deep fried, and lard. It is a big tradition in many Native communities, but its history is steeped in tragedy. Kamimila Bitso is a junior high school student at Horizon Honor Secondary School in Arizona. She made some fry bread and a podcast with her grandmother. Bitso submitted the latter to NPR's Student Podcast Challenge, and today we're bringing you a little taste.
Can you first introduce yourself?
My name is Evelyn Roanhorse, and I'm 80 years old. I'm full-blooded Navajo.
How has fry bread been a part of your life as far as events, different occasions, and celebrations?
I love fry bread. I always have to have fried bread when I see, you know, a stand out and about. I think I've seen it everywhere, you know, all kinds of celebration. There's all different kinds of sizes. Fried bread, small, you know, big.
Like its name suggests, it is a thick fried bread with a puffy texture.
The fried bread has to float in it, so you got to put quite a bit in there.
So how do you say fried bread in Navajo, and what does it mean?
Dahtini lavash. It means bread that rises, so it, you know, so it's called Dahtini Lavash in Navajo.
Dahtini Lavash.
Yeah, it means it kind of goes up like in oil.
While it does hold this cultural significance, it also has complicated origins. The origins of fry bread can be traced back to the 1860s when Southwest tribes, including the Navajo people, or Diné, were forced out of their homelands by the U.S. government to walk hundreds of miles to the Bosque Redondo internment camp in Fort Sumner, New Mexico. Starvation, as the location was not suitable for farming, was common, as the Diné were deprived of the food they had traditionally grown and from proper nutrition. Instead, the government provided simple commodities such as canned foods, flour, lard, salt, baking powder, and sugar. While still facing terrible conditions, the Diné used these rations to create fry bread.
There was really nothing else, you know, that was provided to them. Since they lost, you know, their sheep, you know, that they left that behind, and that was, they needed it, you know, in order to survive. It was a survival thing for them at Fort Sumner.
In 1868, a treaty between Navajo leaders and U.S. officials allowed for the Diné to finally leave the camp and return to their homelands. While the dark period of the internment camp was over, the practice of making fry bread remained and spread among other indigenous tribes, again serving as a cheap way to sustain Native communities in the face of colonial oppression. Fry bread does come with some criticism, though, due to its historical origins and its lack of nutritional value, as it is high in calories and fat. This is connected to the widespread health issues Native communities deal with today, such as chronic diseases like diabetes. While fry bread can definitely contribute to this, the overlying factor can be attributed to Native reservations' lack of resources and access to healthy food and good health care. Overall, while fry bread has a complicated history in relationship with Native tribes, it is undeniably an important symbol within Native culture and has brought tribes together. Final question is, what is your favorite way to enjoy fry bread, or your favorite food to eat with it?
Oh, soup. With soup, yes, or with roast mutton. Mm-hmm. Made into a sandwich. Those are my favorite two ways.
Within families, it creates a nostalgic experience and a way for generations to connect and share knowledge.
That was high school junior Kamimila Bitso.
Support for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge comes from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Programming on KAXE KBXE is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, proud to partner with the Good Relatives Collaborative to announce the 2025 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees, the Minneapolis Indian Center, Mokoche Agricultural Development, and Turtle Mountain Impact. More online at goodrelativescollaborative.org.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A 55-year-old man was rescued on Thanksgiving near Meadowlands after his snowmobile got stuck in a swamp. A news release from the St. Louis County Sheriff's Office says he was snowmobiling Wednesday night about 5 miles northwest of Meadowlands. After his sled got stuck, he found refuge in a remote cabin where he spent the night. He told a friend on Wednesday that he planned to walk to the road the next morning. When the man didn't arrive, the friend called 911. Deputies and the St. Louis County Rescue Squad responded midday and found the man within a couple miles of where he started. He was wet and cold, but otherwise in good condition. These chilly nights have winter recreators excited, but remember, swamps and other bodies of water aren't yet frozen enough for safe travel. Alan Olson and his 18-year-old son Jacob were four-wheeling on the last day of their family vacation in Itasca County this summer. They just pulled onto a dirt road, and Jacob pulled them over to make room for an approaching pickup truck. Olson says if the driver had followed the curve of the road, he would have driven right by. Instead, he drove right into them.
And then I remember sailing through the air, seeing the blue sky, and I remember making a comment to myself that I hope I come down on something soft. Then I impacted on the ground. I could hear can you hear Jacob screaming?
Olson is a Woodbury police officer. Leaning on a crutch last week, he recounted the day his family's life changed as part of the Department of Public Safety's holiday impaired driving extra enforcement campaign. Alan and Jacob were eventually brought to a hospital in Duluth, where Jacob had emergency surgery on his broken arm with 3 torn tendons. Alan had surgery the next day. His femur moved up and broke his hip.
Now I'm going to move on with the rest of my life, whatever that may be, always trying to recover from this. You know, 5 years from now, they talked about I might need a hip replacement. So your two-minute decision before you leave your festivities and decide to get in a car can change not even yourself, but the rest of us and our families.
DPS reminds people that you shouldn't drive after using any substance that impairs your judgment. If you're planning to drink or smoke, also plan a safe and sober ride home. And if you suspect someone is driving impaired, call 911 prepared to provide the location, license plate number, and driving behaviors. We're 1 month out from the start of Minnesota's state-run paid family and medical leave law. The new program will allow nearly all workers up to 12 weeks of family leave and 12 weeks of medical leave, with a total of 20 weeks of leave allowed each year. To get paid leave benefits, you'll apply through the state. To prevent fraud, the application includes verification steps from you, your employer, your health provider, and the state. If you successfully apply for paid leave, you'll get partial wage replacement based on your average weekly pay. Weekly payments are capped at $1,423. Those benefits will be funded by employers and employees. A new payroll tax will go toward the paid leave fund. The rate for 2025 is 0.88%, split between workers and employers. Small businesses pay a reduced rate of 0.66%. Employers can have employees pay up to 44 cents for every $100 you earn. But employers can choose to cover more. Paid leave is a big and sometimes confusing program. The Minnesota Reformer answered some common questions and shared how you can get more answers. Find that story at our website, kaxe.org. The DNR is auctioning off 5 parcels in northern Minnesota through December 16th. The land in Carlton, Clearwater, St. Louis, and Wadena counties may appeal to adjacent landowners or might be good hunting or camping properties. All but 2 of the 190 acres for sale are school trust lands, which generate revenue for a statewide education fund. The DNR is auctioning off the parcels because they have limited opportunities to generate income. For more information, visit kaxe.org. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. It's been a tough year at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The federal agency tasked with protecting the nation's public health has been weakened by staff and budget cuts. NPR health correspondent Ping Huang takes stock.
Aaron Meltzenbacchus started the year as a health communications specialist at CDC. Then the Trump administration started cutting jobs.
So you have the probationary one, that was the Valentine's Day massacre. Then you have the April Fool's Day RIF. And then some people call it the shutdown RIF. Some people call it 1010.
RIF meaning reduction in force. Backus got termination emails in all three rounds, but she's still getting a paycheck from CDC. She's on administrative leave.
So we're still, you know, not doing our jobs.
It's a sign of the chaos. In an email, Andrew Nixon, spokesman for the Department of Health and Human Services, says the CDC has been broken for a long time, and Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is committed to restoring it as the world's most trusted guardian of public health through sustained reform. Nixon added that CDC continues to protect Americans from public health threats, guided by gold standard science and common sense. This year, the CDC has effectively lost a quarter to a third of its staff. That's thousands of people. Programs that aim to reduce smoking or cavities or gun violence were stopped. Workers trained to respond to radiation emergencies or to outbreaks that cause birth defects are gone. To Backus, this is a public health emergency. She and former CDC staff have organized a response, like they've done for disease outbreaks. They gather reports from employees.
How do we collect data on what is being lost at CDC? Because there's not a lot of transparency coming out of the administration.
HHS has declined to confirm numbers or areas that are cut. So Backus's group, called the National Public Health Coalition, is trying to fill the gap. She says CDC staffers are demoralized and appalled by statements about vaccines, autism, measles, which don't reflect the scientific consensus but are put out in the agency's name. Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis resigned in August as a top vaccine official at CDC. He says the agency is not what it used to be.
I keep calling CDC like a zombie because it's a zombie.
He says the first few rounds of cuts to the agency left gaps.
If you had to sort of generate a map, it would be a map that's been eaten by moths because there's just random holes.
Daskalakis says more recent cuts show where the CDC may be headed.
Which is like a very compact thing that does infectious disease responses, maybe some data stuff, and labs. That's it.
He and his former boss, Dr. Deborah Howry, co-wrote a piece in the medical journal The Lancet saying the CDC is in critical condition. Howry was the last career scientist at the CDC's highest levels until she, too, left in August. She says the CDC leadership now lacks important experience.
I really don't see how you can be overseeing priorities and objectives for the agency with zero experience in those areas.
Such as in science and in dealing with state and local health departments. HHS has confirmed a new second-in-command for CDC, Dr. Ralph Abraham, who was Surgeon General of Louisiana. But public health officials are alarmed. earlier this year, Abraham banned the state health department from promoting vaccines. Howery says many of the changes at CDC track with the Project 2025 blueprint from the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation.
Then I also feel like we're living in the upside down world with some of RFK Jr.'s statements around things like gold standard science and radical transparency.
Since he follows up by doing things like cutting the CDC's ethics board, she says. Howery says CDC has lost much more than jobs this year. It's losing trust and the ability to protect the nation from future health crises. Ping Huang, NPR News.
We have an update today on the three Austrian nuns in their 80s who fled a care home and broke back into their former convent in defiance of church authorities. Their superior, the local provost, said the sisters can stay if they give up social media. The nuns rejected these terms, so the provost says the sisters must now answer to Rome. Esme Nicholson has the latest.
Since breaking into their former convent near Salzburg, sisters Bernadette, Regina and Rita have been busy. On Instagram, 82-year-old sister Rita can be seen rushing about the cloisters, even dabbling in a bit of boxing. 86-year-old sister Regina is now so used to climbing four flights of stairs, she forgets to take the recently reinstalled stair lift. And 88-year-old sister Bernadette regularly shares sharp observations about matters both sacred and secular with the sister's growing flock of Instagram followers, currently totaling more than 200,000. Yet the novice influencers are still essentially squatting. Before the church authorities moved the nuns into care, the sisters unwittingly signed over what they understood to be their lifelong right to remain in the cloister. Now their superior provost Markus Grasel says the sisters can stay, but his offer comes with conditions. The nuns must come off social media, stop talking to the press, and cease seeking legal advice. The nuns have rejected the proposal, and Grasel has called on the Vatican to intercede. The nuns say the provost's offer is nothing short of a gag order. Speaking on Instagram, Sister Regina says the press is their protection.
We can't agree to this deal. Without the media, we would have been silenced.
Sister Bernadette, a nun at the convent for 70 years, appealed to the provost.
We need to resolve this, but any agreement we reach must be in accordance with God's will and shaped by human reason.
Canon law scholar and priest Wolfgang Rother told NPR that the deal is neither reasonable nor humane.
The provost's demands are simply unlawful. He seeks to restrict the sisters to such an extent that is nothing less than a violation of their human rights.
The provost's proposed agreement, which NPR has seen, also bans laypersons from entering the cloister, including the sisters' helpers, many of whom they've known for decades. Speaking to NPR on Monday, the provost's spokesperson Harald Schiffel says the sisters' rejection of his offer is regrettable, especially the sisters' refusal to give up their social media presence, which the provost views as unbecoming.
What the sisters show on social media has very little to do with real religious life, and that's why the Abbey is asking them to stay offline.
Sister Bernadette points out that the nun superior is just as media savvy as they are.
The provost and the church invite journalists to the big parties they throw. It helps raise money. Why shouldn't we do the same?
Canon law scholar and priest Rother says there is nothing to stop the provost from removing the sisters a second time because his promise to let the sisters remain is conditioned by the clause until further notice. But the provost's spokesperson Schiffer says the matter is out of his hands.
Ich weiß es wirklich nicht.
I cannot say how to resolve this. It's now up to Rome.
And while they await news from Rome, the sisters continue to follow the papal Instagram account. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered. City council meetings, they're an important part of local governance, but also they're often boring. Emma Vandeninde from member station KUNC takes us to Boulder, Colorado, where they are trying to inject some fun into the process.
City council meetings can often be filled with jargon like this.
Ordinance 8695, amending chapter 10-8.5.
It's super technical and complex, so Boulder leaders took a different approach. They asked an artist to create a living map of the city online, where people could post photos and audio about what they like or want to see change. The project got nearly 150 submissions. There's a variety, like cooking a meal purchased with Snap. Concerns about bike and pedestrian safety.
Constantly people are nearly clipped at that location.
Or simply the joy of enjoying street music.
This is about seeing the city differently.
Chris Carruth was the artist behind the Voicing Boulder project.
I don't think many people, myself included, are walking around thinking about, well, what are the safety issues with the city, or what is an inclusive local economy?
Voicing Boulder is part of what the city is calling experiments in public art. Using artistic community feedback in city planning is unusual, but health researcher Chetima Ibe with the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine has sought artistic feedback in her work. She says it more purely captures public sentiment.
It really emerges from a tradition of community activism and just this idea that the solutions to local problems are found among the people who live in that locality.
But for all of this to work, Ibe says people need to see how their posts directly correlate to policy change, and city leaders need to be present and engaged when considering the recommendations. Boulder Mayor Pro Tem Lauren Folkerts is doing just that.
Go to the south side, that's my side of town.
She's reviewing Voicing Boulder posts on a laptop. At first, Folkerts wasn't sure how this method would pan out, but she likes hearing people's stories through photos and audio.
I think it puts you almost more in the moment of what they're experiencing. It's not pre-curated for us, which so many things on council are.
She's seen a lot of posts about housing and food accessibility. But more than any big overarching goal, she's noticed the little things that deeply matter to people, like adding a streetlight or keeping a beloved bench.
Just these ideas that, like, their human experience was considered. I don't think we would have connected that in the same way without this kind of engagement.
Folkerts is still waiting to see how this all turns out, but she loves how this method brought new perspectives to the table. Matthew Nesselrod is one of those new perspectives. He knows city council meetings are important, but as a busy full-time student, he hasn't made it to one. He decided to participate in the Voicing Boulder project because it was accessible and fun. At a local stream, he hops across the rocks and starts recording on his phone. He's trying to capture the sense of safety he says outdoor spaces can bring. Nesselrod has some doubts about the project, but he's cautiously optimistic.
It was very cool that the city was willing to engage and valued art as a form of data that can actually be implemented or used to consider what we'd like the city to be.
City leaders will discuss the Voicing Boulder recommendations at a December meeting. For NPR News, I'm Emma Vandeninde in Boulder.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. KXE News is working on a story explaining the complex workings behind your property taxes. But we need your help. Share your property tax statement and your questions with us by emailing news@kaxe.org. These real-world examples will help everyone better understand how and why you may be seeing your taxes rise. The news team will contact you and your information will remain confidential. Support comes from Thrive Up North, sharing the stories of a welcoming community of people who've chosen to make Itasca County their new home. Promoting all the area has to offer, including natural amenities and jobs in healthcare, manufacturing, and more. Offering an incentive package to help with your move to the area. Learn more at thriveupnorth.com. Listen to the Season Watch Pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters. Season Watch Pod, for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New episodes come out on Thursdays. We receive support from Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwoods since 1930. Patterson's feature clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smart Wool. Patterson'sClothing.com. The Grand Rapids chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness has a holiday gift drive for those hospitalized with mental illness. New, unwrapped, safe gifts may be dropped off now through December 16th at several locations, including KXE, the Coleraine Public Library, and the McCrosty Arts Center. Ideas include art supplies, puzzle books, gloves, or gift cards. Watermark Arts Center in Bemidji invites you to intercultural creative circles on most Wednesdays, now through March from 11 to 3. Bring your current art project or start a new one with your own materials. Now back to All Things Considered.
Is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump's broad-based tariffs await their legal fate after a Supreme Court hearing last month. It is the latest chapter in an ongoing saga full of jilted trade partners, on-again, off-again deals, and dramatic tariff plot twists. Our colleagues at the Planet Money podcast think of it as an economic soap opera, a soap opera which they've decided to produce. Kenny Malone has the latest installment, The Tariff at the Door.
A doorbell rings inside a New York City apartment. Then again, and again.
One of my biggest pet peeves is when people ring the doorbell multiple times.
Planet Money producer James Sneed. And at his door, UPS.
It was unseasonably warm at the beginning of October. He's wearing shorts. I remember this. I open the door, and immediately he is like, I have this package for you. I need a check for $60. And I was just like, my brain is not computing.
Because James was suddenly in the days of our tariffs, 2 months earlier.
This story starts, as all great modern stories do, on Instagram.
James saw a limited edition doll of D.W. from the cartoon Arthur the Aardvark.
D.W. is very headstrong, has lots of opinions, and at age 4, my kid is a version of D.W.
A collectible gift for his little D.W. He ordered it, $60.
They did have a message at the bottom.
Did you read the message then?
I did not read the message.
Uh-huh.
But I see the message now. Our products ship from Canada and U.S. bound orders may be subject to tariffs.
2 months later, James owed an additional $60 because, yes, there was a 35% tariff on Canadian imports, but also another $24 in UPS import fees plus a $12 fee to pay by check at the door. Now, UPS did tell us you can track your package and pay these import fees ahead of delivery, but if you don't, you will end up like James, getting asked for a check at the door.
So my first reaction was just like, I'm absolutely not paying. And so he's just like, I can't give you your package until you pay for this.
And so for almost a month, that DW doll has been in a warehouse while James decides whether to bail it out of tariff jail. Will James pay? Will it be too late? And what might an expert make of James's tariff at the door situation?
Yeah, hey, I'm Lenny Feldman. I'm a managing partner at the customs and trade law firm of Sandler, Travis, and Rosenberg, based out of Miami, Florida.
And you guys been busy lately?
No, not at all. Things have been really quiet around here.
Lenny explains James's situation.
I don't see it all the time, but I'm not surprised that it is happening.
Because it used to be that packages worth $800 or less were exempt from duties under the de minimis exemption, which earlier this year went away.
Now that you had to pay duties or tariffs, same thing, on these low-value shipments, you needed a party to stand up and say, I'm the importer of record.
Well, is it not my colleague James in this case?
It could be, but in a lot of cases, the express courier is going to serve as the importer of record.
DHL, FedEx, UPS will often serve as the importer, handle tariffs, paperwork, and charge a customer for that. And if you refuse to pay...
Maybe they say, oh, you're not paying it up? Okay, well, we're just going to trash this and abandon it. There's a lot of goods being abandoned.
Okay, so in James's case, do you think they took it back to the border and trashed it?
You have to ask UPS.
Meanwhile, James did decide to pay his import fees online, but it's been days, no package. Then one night,
I got home and on my front steps was a box
from...
It's not destroyed!
Take out my handy-dandy box cutter.
He pulls out the DW doll.
Would I tell you this is my child? Like, this picture is quintessential my kid.
So how much are you in total? 111 or something?
Plus, like, a whole lot of heartache.
Was it worth it? Will the Supreme Court overturn Trump's tariffs? Will James order anything internationally again? Tune in next time on Days of Our Tariffs.
That special report on international trade comes from Kenny Malone and our colleagues at the Planet Money podcast. You can hear the full episode. Search for Planet Money wherever you listen to podcasts.
Support for Planet Money comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Tens of millions of people who took road trips over the holiday weekend had an extra reason to be thankful: the lowest gas prices in more than 4 years. AAA says the average price of regular gas nationwide has dropped to just $3 a gallon. NPR's Scott Horsley has the lowdown.
Gas prices vary widely from state to state, and many parts of the country have seen pump prices starting with a 2 for months now. Still, when the average price nationwide drops to $3 a gallon, that's a milestone, especially at a time when many Americans are anxious about the overall cost of living. AAA spokeswoman Aixa Diaz says it's the first time the national average has dropped this low since the spring of 2021.
The biggest factor in 2025 has been the lower price of crude oil. There has been a lot of crude oil in the market. OPEC Plus has been pumping oil into the market. Now you're talking about a time of year when gas demand goes down, and that's keeping prices down.
Not everyone is seeing the same savings. Gas in California still cost $4.56 a gallon on average, and the closing of an oil refinery in Los Angeles last month is not likely to help. Meanwhile, gas in Oklahoma cost just over half as much, $2.41 a gallon. Falling fuel prices have not trickled down to the diesel pump. On average, diesel fuel costs about 20 cents a gallon more now than it did a year ago. That's partly due to a drop in diesel exports from Russia. At the same time, winter demand for heating oil is picking up. Monty Wiederhold, who runs a trucking company in southern Ohio, adds a surcharge to his freight rates to cover the higher diesel cost. He knows that extra expense will get passed along in other prices.
I'm a consumer just like you are. When I go to the store, you know, and I buy a gallon of milk or a pound of butter, fuel is in absolutely everything that we buy. You know, if you got it, a truck brought it.
The Trump administration is counting on a domestic energy boom to help keep other prices in check. But if oil prices stay this low, the president may not see the surge of drilling he's been hoping for. The administration's been opening lots of new territory to oil drilling while also relaxing environmental restrictions. But domestic oil production has risen only modestly from what was already a record high level last year. West Texas crude oil is trading for less than $60 a barrel today. That's below the break-even point many oil producers say they need to justify drilling new wells. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Focus Features presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From Imaginable Futures, envisioning a future where learning sparks opportunity and thriving belongs to everyone. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley-Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the First National Bank of Coleraine since 1906, serving the needs of the community and working with their friends and neighbors, with branches in Coleraine and Grand Rapids. More information at ColeraineBank.com, member FDIC. Looking at weather tonight, cloudy skies, lows 1 to 6 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 19 to 20.